Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, April 1st, and I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMED. In tonight's news, Humboldt County Community Health Assessment open for residents to weigh in on health of community. Federal court overturns regulations that weakened the Endangered Species Act. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
After a notably dry winter for Humboldt County, the National Weather Service reported Eureka's rainfall 0.48 inches for the month of March. This marks the driest March in 100 years, and the second driest on record, with March of 1926 still holding the record at a meager 0.07 inches. Eureka's rainfall was 6.27 inches below average for the month, with the entire county experiencing dry conditions. Snowpack is also a concern, with high temperatures contributing to severe drought conditions. The California Department of Resources reports the Northern Sierra and Trinity regions holding only 6% of their normal snowpack for April 1st. The Humboldt County Department of Health and Human Services has opened the Humboldt County Community Health Assessment so that residents can weigh in and make known health issues important to them in the community. Nat Cardos reports.
The Humboldt County Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS, has opened the Humboldt County Community Health Assessment, CHA, survey, which will be open until April 15th. The survey is approximately 15 minutes long and encourages participants to express what needs should be prioritized in Humboldt County to improve the health of the community. KMOD News spoke with Brianna Sherlock, who works for Humboldt County Public Health, for more about the survey.
So the Community Health Assessment is like a checkup for our entire community. It helps us tell the community story, looking at what makes us healthy and what are the problems that we face. The information that we gather in the Community Health Assessment is for local leaders and organizations to understand what our community's needs are from our community's perspective and helps them make informed decisions that can improve our community's health overall.
The survey is conducted to help DHHS update the Community Health Improvement Plan, CHIP, for planning and policymaking.
The survey is conducted once every 3 years. So it's an ongoing process throughout those 3 years where we're constantly looking at what are the priorities that were identified and how are we advancing to improve our overall health. And then once every 3 years, we do a big scan doing the community health assessment and looking at other health data in our community, like cancer rates, prenatal appointments, youth commercial tobacco use, and many other indicators.
In the past, the CHA has identified issues important to the community such as suicide prevention, substance use, housing instability, healthy beginnings, and adverse childhood experiences. Once identified, the DHHS incorporated solutions into the CHIP.
So for suicide prevention, the Suicide Network, along with Public Health Suicide Prevention Program, work together to distribute lockboxes throughout our community so that folks who are interested had the ability to lock up their guns to make them safer for themselves, their families, and their community. Another thing that came out of that from substance use was hiring a care coordinator to help with medication-assisted treatment, or MAT, for folks that are using substances and are interested in getting into treatment. The MAT care coordinator helps connect them with programs and helps navigate that system to get them into treatment.
Once again, the survey is open until April 15th and can be accessed on livewellhumboldt.org. This is Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD News.
This week, a United States District Court in the Northern District of California overturned four provisions in the Endangered Species Act that the Trump administration issued in 2019 during his first term. This ruling comes from a 2024 lawsuit that was filed in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California by the Center for Biological Diversity, Sierra Club, and Wild Earth Guardians, all being represented by Earth Justice. The United States District Judge that made the final ruling was John S. Tiger. KMUD talked with Ryan Shannon, a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity in their Endangered Species Program. He gave background of the Endangered Species Act and why this ruling is so important.
The Endangered Species Act provides essential protections for endangered and threatened species in their habitat, and it's been incredibly successful at doing so, largely preventing the extinction of all species protected under it. And statutes are often accompanied by implementing regulations that flesh out the statutory provisions. In this case, those regulations are promulgated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service. And since the Act's passing, those implementing regulations were largely unaltered for decades. But in 2019, during the first Trump administration, Trump proposed sweeping challenges to the implementing regulations and gutted key provisions. We challenged those in court, but then the Biden administration came in and said they were going to revisit those regulations, and the court allowed them to do so. Unfortunately, Biden finalized revisions in 2024, and while they did get rid of some of the most egregious aspects of the Trump regulations, they left them largely intact. So we, the Center for Biological Diversity, along with Sierra Club and Wild Earth Guardians, represented by Earth Justice and me, sued again to overturn the 2019 and 2024 revisions. And that's what we're talking about today, with the court issuing an order on Monday striking down many of the regulations as contrary to the Endangered Species Act.
The ruling focused on Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act. Shannon went into detail about this section and the provisions that were ruled on.
What this section does is it requires all federal agencies to ensure that their actions do not jeopardize listed species or adversely modify their critical habitat, the habitat that's been deemed essential to their survival and recovery. And to do so, agencies have to look at the effects of their actions and what those impacts will be based on the best available science, and then they have a duty to avoid jeopardy and adverse modification and to minimize the impacts of those actions.
The court has four different regulatory provisions that were ruled on. The first was the definition of adverse modification, Shannon explained.
First, the court overturned their definition of destruction or adverse modification. What they tried to do is say destruction and adverse modification only occurs if it impacts the species' critical habitat as a whole. And so you think about this in the context of something like the northern spotted owl. You have millions of acres of designated critical habitat. And so if you're looking at the impacts of any given clear cut, you know, the clear cut might only cover 5,000 acres. Well, that's a fraction of a percent of the critical habitat designation as a whole. And so they would always say, no destruction or adverse modification. And the judge said, no, that's not what the statute means. It asks, are you destroying or adversely modifying critical habitat? And you can't dilute that by looking at the critical habitat designation as a whole. Doing so violates the plain language of the Act.
The second makes sure that all agencies have to consider all available science and not exclude information.
He also overturned a provision that seeked to cabin the types of effects from agency actions that they would look at. They stated that they were only going to look at those effects that wouldn't occur but for the proposed action, and then critically are reasonably certain to occur. It's kind of amorphous, high bar. But the Endangered Species Act requires the agencies to utilize the best available science, all of the available science, when making their determination about whether or not their action is going to destroy or adversely modify critical habitat. And the court said, this reasonably certain to occur threshold is too high. It's prohibiting the agencies from looking at certain effects that might not be, quote unquote, reasonably certain to occur. So a good example of this that's very relevant right now is the Gulf oil biop, the same biop that the God Squad was meeting about yesterday. In that biop, they're looking at the impacts of oil and gas development in the Gulf. And they said, we're not going to consider the impact of catastrophic oil spill, another deepwater horizon, because it might occur, but it's not reasonably certain to occur. It may happen, it might not happen. And so they completely excluded the consideration of that effect from their analysis of whether or not oil development in the Gulf is going to jeopardize endangered species like the rice whale. And the court said, you can't do that. It violates your duty to consider the best available science and determine whether or not jeopardy and adverse modification is likely.
The third provision ruled on make sure that critical habitat will now be protected, and any plans made have to include specific binding commitments that can't be changed after approval.
Third provision, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, when they're looking at whether or not an agency action is going to jeopardize a listed species or adversely modify their critical habitat, they get a lot of information from the action agency about what the action is so that they can analyze the effects. And what they tried to do is say, anything that you want to propose as potentially minimizing those effects, we're going to take that at face value. We're not going to peek under the hood, you know, ascertain whether or not you have funding for it, whether or not you actually have like specific binding plans, whether, you know, you have agreements in place to buy land, to offset the impacts, et cetera. We're just going to take it at face value. And the court struck that down, saying, no, you know, Ninth Circuit precedent on this is very clear. To comply with your duty to insure against jeopardy and adverse modification, you can't go off of promises or a plan to make a plan. You have to have specific binding commitments, funding, et cetera, before you can take into account the efforts that the agency might make to minimize those impacts.
Shannon explained the fourth and final provision that was ruled on.
In the fourth provision, this duty to insure against jeopardy and adverse modification is an ongoing duty. So even after an agency has approved an agency action, they still have to ensure throughout the entirety of that agency action that they're insuring against jeopardy and adverse modification. You know, new information might become available, the project might be modified, or just has effects that they didn't anticipate at the time that they were originally analyzing it. And to address that, they go through this process called reinitiation of consultation, where they go back and they reanalyze the effects of the agency action. And for the longest time, the regulations made clear that the action agencies, you know, whether it's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, military, whatever the case may be, they have a duty to reinitiate consultation, but the services themselves also have a duty to request reinitiation when they have reason to believe that there's new information that needs to be addressed through consultation. And in 2024, the Biden administration stripped that provision from the regulations requiring the services to request reinitiation. And the judge overturned that and said, this regulation had been on the books for decades. It serves an important purpose, and you can't just decide without adequate explanation to get rid of your duty to request reinitiation of consultation and make sure that impacts affecting endangered and threatened species are being considered.
This will have positive environmental effects all over America, but also in the North Coast. Shannon talked about the northern spotted owl and how clear-cutting will now have to jump through more environmental regulations to get approved.
The northern spotted owl, you know, for decades, the services have gotten away with allowing clear-cutting of old-growth forests within the northern spotted owl's critical habitat under this theory that they only have to consider whether or not those impacts are adversely modifying critical habitat as a whole. And now that that has been struck down by the court, they're going to have to actually analyze what are the impacts of any given clear cut. What are those localized impacts on the northern spotted owl? So hopefully, you know, we will see stronger protections being in place to protect that old growth habitat that's so essential and emblematic of Northern Californian forests.
As of today, these regulations are in effect, forcing agencies to comply with this new ruling. Currently, the Trump administration is trying to reinstate the 2019 revision, but that has not been finalized yet. Shannon said they are going to have to wait and see what the current administration will do with this new ruling, with the possibility that they will appeal this decision, but nothing has been filed yet. In state news, LGBTQ plus advocates slam Supreme Court ruling on conversion therapy. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Groups that advocate for the LGBTQ plus community are slamming Monday's Supreme Court decision overturning a Colorado law banning conversion therapy for minors. Justice Neil Gorsuch argued for the majority that the bill violated therapists' First Amendment free speech rights. Jorge Reyes-Salinas with Equality California says conversion therapy, which tries to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity, hurts patients by fostering self-loathing.
Every major medical and mental health organization continues to condemn conversion therapy because of its harmfulness. It creates depression, anxiety, and suicide.
20 states, including California, ban conversion therapy for minors. This Supreme Court decision doesn't lift those bans immediately, but it does make them vulnerable to legal challenge. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson argued in her dissent that states should be able to regulate professional conduct in the medical field without running afoul of the First Amendment. Angela Dallara with the nonprofit advocacy group GLAAD says we need to prioritize people's right to effective, science-based medical care.
We must amplify the voices of survivors and continue to hold viable anyone who peddles in this junk science. Conversion practices are also very much a form of medical malpractice and consumer fraud because they don't work.
In California, adults can sue for medical malpractice if they believe they have been harmed by conversion therapy. A new bill in the state legislature, Senate Bill 934, would make it easier to sue and extends the time limit for filing a suit. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Israel kills three journalists in Lebanon, one killed by drone after she survived first strike. KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
Those killed have been identified as well-known television correspondents Ali Shuyab, along with Fatima Fatouni and her brother, freelance photojournalist Mohammed Fatouni. Eyewitnesses say Fatima survived the initial blast and attempted to flee, but was later killed in a drone strike. Witnesses described the scene as her being hunted down. In a separate vehicle, her colleague, cameraman Hussein Saeed Naji, was seen in distress, holding Fatouni's press vest, now torn to shreds. His comments translated by Sky News.
How's the media meant to witness what Israel's doing? They're committing massacres against journalists. These press vests don't protect anyone.
Lebanon's President Joseph Aoun and Information Minister Paul Marcos have condemned the attack. President Aoun called it, quote, a blatant crime that violates all norms and treaties under which journalists enjoy international protection in war, close quote. Notably, this was not the first time Fatouni and her colleagues had been targeted. 18 months earlier, they were struck by an Israeli bomb while sleeping in a hotel in southern Lebanon. Fatouni survived that attack, but two of her colleagues were killed. At the time, she said her only weapon was her microphone.
This is what remains of my shield and my helmet and the weapon that we carry. This is the weapon for which the Israeli warplanes raided us. And do we possess another weapon? Perhaps this weapon pained them, and it is indeed so. And we emphasize from atop of the rubble of houses and the destruction here on Hasbaya, we are continuing to convey the truth and the reality and the crimes of the Israeli occupation to the last breath.
In the video, she would hold her microphone up from the rubble. And earlier this month, she reported live on air as seven of her own family members were killed in an Israeli strike on their home. Broadcaster Ali Shoyab also faced previous attacks, in part due to his reporting for the Hezbollah-affiliated Al-Manar TV. But the Committee to Protect Journalists and its regional director, Sarah Kuda, says journalists are not legitimate targets, regardless of the outlet they work for.
We have seen a disturbing pattern in this war and in the decades prior of Israel accusing journalists of being active combatants and terrorists without providing any credible evidence. Journalists are not legitimate targets.
Israel openly acknowledged to targeting Shoab. A move the Committee to Protect Journalists says shows a clear disregard for international law. In a post on X, the Israel Defense Forces wrote, quote, "Eliminated. For years, Ali Shoaib operated as a Hezbollah Rodwan Force terrorist under the guise of a journalist. Turns out the press vest was just a cover for terror," close quote. The post included a split image of the reporter, showing him holding a microphone on one side and what the military claimed are images of him in military gear on the other. However, even Fox News questioned the claim. Here's correspondent Trey Yangst debunking the photo.
When asked by Fox News about the source of the photo, the IDF responded, quote, "Unfortunately, there isn't really a picture of it. It was photoshopped."
CPJ says they have emailed the IDF requesting further information regarding the targeting and killing of all three journalists, which includes a request for evidence supporting the allegations. However, in a reply, they stated that the incident is being further investigated. The IDF's treatment of the media came under renewed scrutiny this weekend as a CNN crew in the West Bank was reportedly attacked. CNN's Jerusalem correspondent Jeremy Diamond described what happened in their report.
The commander comes straight for our camera, and within seconds... A soldier has just put photojournalist Cyril Theophilus in a chokehold, forcing him to the ground.
Don't touch him like that. Give me my phone.
The report they were working on examined how Israeli settler violence in the occupied West Bank is surging again amid the war. Following the report's publication, the Israeli military told CNN that one of the soldiers involved had been dismissed, along with other unprecedented disciplinary actions against the battalion following the detention and assault of journalists. While CNN's Jeremy Diamond praised the swift response, he noted there is often a lack of accountability in similar incidents.
The swiftness and the scale of this response is only really happening in large part because of who we are. Because we are journalists working for an American news network, we have seen incidents similar to this before involving Palestinian journalists where there is no accountability.
For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
In National Native News, Jill Freitas reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. The Federal Emergency Management Agency last week opened $1 billion in grants for disaster management. The news comes after the agency terminated the program for that work a year ago. But a federal court found that termination unlawful and ordered the agency to restart it. Aliona Nyden with the Alaska Desk has more on what that means for some tribes in Alaska.
FEMA opened applications for a program to help communities protect themselves from fires, floods, earthquakes, and hurricanes. The agency canceled the program last year, but a federal judge in the U.S. District of Massachusetts ordered that the agency reinstate the funding. Dustin Ivan is Tribal Resilience Coordinator for the village of Quiquilingok in Western Alaska, one of the villages hit hardest by the ex-Typhoon Halong. The village participated in the FEMA program before it was canceled. Ivan says it is still unclear how useful the new version of the program will be for Alaska villages like his.
There's good news, but we'll see how it goes. So a lot of these grants don't really fit our rural Alaska villages.
Last spring, FEMA canceled its program called Building Resilient Infrastructure in Communities, also known as BRIC. The agency called it wasteful, ineffective, and too concerned with political agendas. 20 states sued FEMA in response. Quiquilingok residents for years have been working to protect themselves from flooding and erosion and voted to relocate several years ago. In 2022, the village was accepted into the BRIC program to select a relocation site. Village leaders also applied for another BRIC grant to do a feasibility study for the site, but the program was canceled.
We're all devastated. It's like a year and a half of work all down the drain.
FEMA said BRIC has a few changes following the order to relaunch. The agency said it will eliminate phased projects, funding for hazard mitigation planning, and technical assistance provisions, the very things that tribes like Quiglingog applied for in the past. Yvonne says he's concerned that the agency is not planning to do phased projects.
Alaska has four seasons, and we can only do summer to freeze up projects. The project we were planning was going to be a multi-year and in phases.
The application for the program is open until late July. In Anchorage, I am Alona Knighton.
A new partnership between journalism and legal experts aims to improve how stories are reported across Indian country. The Indigenous Journalists Association and the Center for Indigenous Law and Justice at UC Berkeley School of Law announced a national collaboration this week focused on strengthening coverage of Native nations. The effort will provide journalists with training in federal Indian law, tribal sovereignty, and best practices for reporting in Native communities. Mary Lopez Kiefer, Executive Director of the Center of Indigenous Law and Justice, said in a joint statement announcing the partnership, quote, "By working together, we can ensure that reporting on Indian country is grounded in legal accuracy, cultural respect, and a deeper understanding of tribal governance." Leaders say many of the most important issues in Indian country, like missing and murdered Indigenous people, water rights, and child welfare, are shaped by complex legal systems that are often misunderstood. Organizers say the collaboration will include workshops, webinars, and national training opportunities aimed at improving the accuracy and integrity of reporting on Native nations. I'm Jill Freitas.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Nat Cardos, Suzanne Potter, Lauren Schmidt, and Jill Freitas. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org. And now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.